Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Stafer, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Vice President Kamala Harris sat for three interviews during the Democratic National Convention. None were with a journalist. Instead, Harris gave her first interviews since Biden left the race to three social media influencers. It was a choice that signified how important content creators have become, especially in this election cycle. Wired senior writer McKenna Kelly was at the DNC in Chicago. She's been covering political influencers since 2018, and she joins us now. Welcome to All Sides, McKenna.
Hi, it's great to be here.
About 200 content creators got badges for the Democratic National Convention, but unlike traditional journalists, those passes came with some extra perks. There was a Creators for Kamala cruise, a platform close to the main stage, comped hotel rooms, free alcohol. Am I missing any of these perks?
No, I think you're really getting all of it. And I think, you know, we want to point out specifically that there were multiple tiers of content creators as well. So there were some who had a lot more access to even more broadcast rooms. So kind of the same kind of sweet boxes as you see like Fox News and CNN using that they could book for time. And then also there are other tiers of reporters as well. I, of course, was in the lower tier. So unlike a lot of these creators, I unfortunately didn't even have a seat in the building or a place to plug my computer in.
Now, do we know who paid for all of these perks for the content creators?
I'm not entirely sure. So there was a lot of different groups. There was the DNC, of course, but there were third-party groups like Amplify and other management companies that hosted their own parties, and I'm assuming they paid for them.
And some of the creators cover politics, or they work on issues that they're passionate about, like immigration or reproductive rights. Others, I was a little befuddled by. So there's a guy named Jeremy Jacobitz. I hope I'm saying that right. He's a food influencer with more than 800,000 followers. Why was a food guy invited to the DNC?
Well, when you look at like the Democrats' strategy this year, it hasn't just been trying to talk to people in political channels, but talking to people in apolitical channels as well. And when you look at someone like Jeremy, who does these food reviews, he still likes to talk about politics. He told me when I met him there that he loves to insert whatever he thinks into his channel as well, but it's primarily, you know, his food reviews. And so when you talk to people at the DNC, they're looking for people trying to reach audiences and people who might not be engaged by CNN political audiences, but also just people who don't seek out political news themselves. And this is a way to do that.
Oh, it's about getting on their FYPs.
Exactly.
Yeah, so you did follow a couple of different influencers around the convention, including Hassan Piker, who has more than 2.7 million followers on Twitch, and Philip DeFranco. Can you give us a sense of what they were reporting on or what kind of content they were creating at the convention?
Philip DeFranco, I still need to see what he posted, but he was in one of those boxes with the stage behind him, and he was interviewing Representative Ro Khanna. And what he did is he, you know, asked a lot of similar questions that we would, but I think a lot of it was discussing what's it like having influencers at the DNC for the first time. And then you have Hassan Piker, who has, you know, several million followers across platforms. He is known as one of the most influential political commentators online. And he, you know, he sat there and he talked to Ro Khanna on a number of topics like the wealth tax, about, you know, Palestinian rights and all kinds of issues that he actually, you know, they were tougher questions. And, you know, something when I talked to Ro Khanna after these interviews, I said, you know, what do you think about talking to creators? Are they actually holding you accountable? And it was funny enough, he told me that some of the creators, like people like Breonna Joy Gray's podcast and people like that, might hold him to account a little bit more than some journalists do.
And, you know, the Harris campaign has also been very active on social media themselves. Kamala HQ has amassed a significant following on TikTok. They seem very tuned in to how to grab the attention of younger voters.
Yeah, and I think the strategy here when you talk to people on the campaign is they want to acknowledge that this energy is happening, but they don't want to start doing it themselves and lean into what, you know, what we could call cringe territory.
Yeah, and three influencers got to interview Vice President Kamala Harris, something no journalist has done since she became the nominee. How did they get those interviews?
Sure. So I think, it's working with the campaign specifically. A lot of influencers are part of these vast influencer networks that the Biden campaign has been building since 2020 and got handed off to Kamala, just a few weeks ago. And so even the White House has its own network. And so these people obviously have connections to the White House. The White House and like the campaign have their own agendas. They know who they want to talk to, the specific audiences they want to talk to. And I'm assuming, that's how those interviews started.
And it's not just the DNC. The Republican National Convention also issued credentials to influencers, not as many. They issued about 70, right?
Yeah, so not nearly as many. A lot of these people are also familiar faces that you see online, like Charlie Kirk and Turning Point people, but significantly fewer of them. And honestly, I don't remember. It was really hard. I had to search for those influencers, right? They weren't just coming across my For You page. These things weren't really going as, viral and being as widely seen as a lot of what the Democrats were doing.
And it doesn't sound like they got as many perks as content creators at the DNC did.
No, I didn't see any. Free hot dogs and alcohol.
Why do you think both campaigns decided to credential content creators this year? It's not that they've like prohibited them from attending in the past, but they got separate badges, they got separate rooms. Like, why make it so official this year?
I think it has to do a lot with how the internet has changed since 2020. Like, go back to 2020, and we had a rush of campaigns figuring out how to use the internet because of the coronavirus pandemic. And now, they kind of like rushed into that. And now they have all of this, work on influencers and content creators. But even now, like looking at the internet, how it's changed, Elon Musk owns X now, formerly Twitter. Facebook and Instagram now are deprioritizing political content. Even if you used X, maybe you use Blue Sky now because you don't like Elon Musk. Same with like Mastodon. And audiences are extremely fractured online. You can't just like post, no campaign can now just post a press release or a video to Twitter and expect everyone, in the country to see it. Like, when Donald Trump would tweet in 2020, we don't have those moments anymore. And so I think, why these campaigns use these influencers is because these influencers have direct relationships with their audiences. They're probably more engaged and they want to reach those audiences because otherwise there's probably not a lot of other ways to reach them online.
Yeah, you describe it as a bespoke FYP. So your page is very curated to you and what you like, and your algorithm learns that. And that makes sense. It's much harder to break in. If your algorithm knows that you love food content video and cookie decorating videos, like it's not going to give you a traditional DNC video.
No, and that's why we're seeing people who are just lifestyle influencers, food influencers, people who, maybe traditionally don't do a lot of politics getting involved with this, at least on the DNC side for sure.
Has there been any like backlash, or have any of these content creators who aren't political by nature received any kind of pushback for, say, attending the DNC?
Yeah, I think that was the story of last week. Was a lot of tension between the journalists who were there and some of the content creators. Content creators, were posting about how they were being sneered at by journalists, and journalists, of course, were upset that they were taking up seats that maybe they could have had, and that's, continued into this week where we're seeing still a lot of discussion, which leads into really like the question of what is a journalist? And I feel like we have that conversation every couple of years at this point, but it's really, riled back up again.
Yeah, Wired also put together this really creative interactive display that shows how personalities on the right and left are using their massive followings to influence this election. And the bigger the bubble, essentially, the more influence. And the largest bubble by far was Elon Musk.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at Elon Musk, of course, he's the founder of Tesla, he does SpaceX and all these things. But owning X, he basically has become like the largest content creator. He is constantly posting, ever since he endorsed Donald Trump after the assassination attempt in Butler, Pennsylvania, he has become a big spokesperson and megaphone for the Republicans and primarily Donald Trump.
Yeah, you had this interview with him on X too.
Right. Yeah, that did not go so well at the beginning. It took about 45 minutes for it to start. I don't know when they're going to learn that, these that even the last time with Ron DeSantis, it didn't start out too well. So, yeah.
Yeah. And then on the left, you see people like Carlos Eduardo Espina. He has 10 million followers on TikTok. He's an immigrant rights activist. He's a Democrat. Now, is he the one that got the speaking? Like, he actually got to speak at the DNC?
Yes, he was able to speak. He was one of the, I think it was like three or four or five of them.
That's also interesting to me. Not only like are they there creating content, they are literally creating content for the DNC as well by giving these speeches.
Yeah, but I think, you know, it's important to look at what these audiences are like. I think a lot of people discount these creators as being simply, you know, influencers. And maybe that puts, you know, people have like an idea of these influencers not really doing much. But when you look at Carlos Eduardo Ospina and Olivia Juliana and the people who spoke on stage, I think, you know, first and foremost, they are activists who maybe just do a lot of their activism online.
Yeah, I think, you know, for some reason, when the word influencer, rightly or wrongly, comes up, you imagine this attractive young woman like showing off her makeup and clothes on the internet, which is really does not encompass like the full breadth and depth of what it means to be large on social media.
Yeah, I mean, people do all kinds of content, political content now. There's video game content, all this kind of stuff, and all those audiences are now important to campaigns. It's different. I think people, especially maybe even some journalists last week, have that idea in their head that an influencer doesn't ask tough questions, that they aren't doing important work. But, you know, even over the last 5 years, you could look at YouTube and the development of like those long form video essays. Some of those are the more well-researched, you know, informational journalism that I've read in a long time. And so when you look at journalists and creators, I have to be optimistic about it and think like when we look back to the bloggers being involved in the Bush administration, like now you wouldn't say the Vox.com person in the White House press room is a blogger, they're a reporter, right? And that kind of difference doesn't exist anymore. And I have a feeling that maybe in the next couple of years, what you'll see is the best parts of content creation and journalism coming together to create, you know, maybe to be able to be more persuasive to audiences, to have more, you know, engaging conversations with audiences and to open up, you know, the work that we do every day to show them, you know, the source building and all of that to build trust.
Yeah, if you think about it, I mean, this is going to date me a little, but like Ezra Klein got his start as a political blogger.
Right. And now he's one of the most influential political influencers, you could call him, podcasters, everything.
Yeah. I want to ask, you know, there were some names like Logan Paul. He's one of the biggest influencers on the Republican side. He's got 23 million followers on YouTube. He's a professional wrestler, which I found sort of fascinating.
Yeah, so Trump has always had this connection to the UFC and wrestling, especially through Dana White, who, of course, gave the introductory speech to Trump at the RNC just a couple weeks ago. And so Trump has always had this association with this hyper-masculine type of person, whether it is Hulk Hogan or even now who the new Hulk Hogans arguably would be Logan Paul and Jake Paul. And, you know, it's still a similar audience, but those audiences are elsewhere now.
Yeah, well, Hulk Hogan also made an appearance at the RNC, so.
Yeah, he created a lot of content and memes by ripping off his shirt, if I remember correctly.
It's very on brand for him, though. Like, that did not surprise me. So where do you think this goes from here? Like, I have seen journalists make forays into, you know, Instagram Reels and to TikTok. I think Planet Money, an NPR podcast, does a really excellent job. They have a massive following on social media. So it, like, at a certain point, are we just going to blur the line between journalist and, say, political TikToker?
I think that's the case. And especially if it's not, you know, if it isn't going to be already, I feel like a lot of journalists are going to push for that because these content creators who, you know, are primarily content creators who don't work with editors, they were able to do a lot of these interviews on the ground. But I, too, you know, and a lot of journalists that I know who work for magazines, who work for newspapers, who, you know, have their own newsletters, whatever it is, they are also shooting vertical video. Their editors are also demanding TikTok content. And we're already seeing those demands being placed on journalists that content creators do every day. And so I have a feeling at some point there needs to be some recognition that maybe not all content creators are journalists, but a lot of journalists are content creators, right? And at some point, I think that line will blur and will in the same way that we saw with the bloggers in the Bush administration.
Although I don't know that we'll ever see the day where the journalists get the free booze and hot dog room at the convention. That would get ethically weird.
I think a lot of those lower tier past journalists kind of just wanted a place to plug in their laptop in the center.
That's totally fair. I think a desk and a chair and an outlet is basic.
Right.
So I have to ask then, given that you've been covering influencers for so many years, has it changed the way you approach your own reporting or perhaps the way you share it on social media?
I think the main way that, so when I got into journalism, I had this idea that if I could be Thomas Pynchon and nobody needed to know my face, they just knew my name, that would be the most ideal job for me. But that is not the case. That is not the way that journalism is right now. It never was. But it's, you just can't do that. And so I think, what I've learned by watching these content creators and looking at, the work that a lot of other websites are doing and journalists are doing is that we need to be able to be more than this black in white serif font on a newspaper or on a blog. These names, we have to do faces, we need to have faces to these names, and we need to do similar work to what creators do, where even if it's just doing a newsletter where you maybe blog a bit more, or you're doing TikTok videos where you're describing the process with which you reached a current story, I think that might be able to address a lot of the concerns voters have with media right now, with being a bit more transparent about the process, and maybe then we'll be able to earn more trust back.
That was Wired senior writer McKenna Kelly. She's been covering political influencers since 2018. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
It was great to be here.
Coming up, we're talking about how to ensure that your kids make friends while not overdoing it on social media. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from the Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides, where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. I'm your host, Anna Staver. The start of the school year can bring a mix of feelings for kids and parents, from the excitement of new teachers and classmates to the anxiety over all that newness. Teachers and parents want children to forge classroom connections, to have that sense of belonging. But a new report finds that many parents worry technology gets in the way of meaningful connections at school. Here to talk about it with me is Dr. Ariana Howitt. She's the executive clinical director of the Kids Mental Health Foundation, which issued that report earlier this month. She's also a pediatric psychologist at Nationwide Children's Hospital. Welcome to All Sides, Ariana.
Thanks for having me.
So when I think of back to school and my own children, so much of the way that they interact with their peers now after school, the way they build connection, the way they invite each other to hang out, it's all done across technology.
Exactly. We have a new way of socializing. And sometimes our kids are socializing in this way and we don't understand it as the adults, as the parents. And so we're playing catch up to them.
Yeah. If, gone are the days where you call the house phone and you're like, is Sarah there? Would she want to get together and play? That's like not how it's done anymore.
No. And a lot of kids have their own devices, right? And so what I hear in my clinic and my patients is that they sometimes are aware that they have lost those social skills. They get nervous. Start of school, those transitions of, I don't know how to make friends. I don't know how to start that conversation because there is these new ways of interacting.
And I think some of it is just a change in the way we do it. So instead of like group calls on like a house phone, it might be like a FaceTime call.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Which feels very like just what I did as a kid, but different.
Yeah. And all the group chats that allow us to stay connected, sharing pictures, sharing videos. It's a form of connection, just different.
So how do you balance that as the parent? Because you want your kid, maybe to be in those chats, to have those connections, to be having those calls with their peers.
Right. For parents right now, it's a really tough choice because we know that there are some risks to technology. And so the parent is having to decide, do I give my child access to this? And then there's the risk. Or do I keep them from this technology? But then they may be excluded because all their peers are using these technologies. And so it's a tough decision for parents to make right now.
Especially when it comes to some of those online games that they can play, like Roblox or Minecraft, and the way they can co-create. And
I don't know. It's hard to know how much access you want to give them in these situations.
Right. There's so many benefits. You can connect. You can create. You can be creative. You can find people that are like you and have your same interests. And that is great for children. And then if we are not monitoring, we're worried about, are they talking to people that are not their age? Are they talking to people that are harmful?
Pretending to be their age.
Exactly. Or are they consuming content that is not for them or that can be harmful? And so it's all about monitoring and knowing what kids are doing. But again, they're really tech savvy, so sometimes we don't know.
Yeah, that's one of the things we've talked about a lot on the show, is how algorithms and your For You page learns what you like and then feeds you more of it, even if it's content about self-harm, mm-hmm. if it's racist, homophobic, if it's really violent content, if it says, hey, you really like this, it's going to give you more of it.
Exactly. And that's what we worry about, is what is the child consuming? Are they seeing these things that increase their risk for things like depression, self-harm, eating disorders? Or are they seeing things that make them more civically engaged, connected? Are they learning something? And your point, it is a good way for parents to know what our kids are watching, is by looking at the For You page, because you can see what the algorithm is suggesting to them.
So the Kids Mental Health Foundation encourages making a family social media plan, and you have a video that lays this out. But what I love about it is the idea that, like, I should be just as involved in how I'm going to access social media.
Yes, it's called Family Plan for a reason. We are models to our children. Kids learn by watching us. We know that sometimes kids feel like we are on our phones too much. And so if we are setting boundaries and rules for our kids, we have to follow those boundaries and rules ourselves. And so the family plan, you can download on our website. It is free for families to use. And it guides parents on what apps am I using? Who am I communicating with? What am I posting? Are there times that the family is off technology? And so, again, it's something for the whole family. And the idea is you continue to check in, and that plan may change over time.
Yeah, it could be something as simple as no phones at the dinner table.
Yes.
Everybody charges their phone outside of their bedroom at night.
Yes. Gosh, sleep is so important to kids and so disrupted by technology. So that's a big one.
Are there signs that indicate that your child's gotten out of balance with their technology use? Like, what should we be looking for?
Yes, you know your child best. So if you see changes in their behavior, in their mood, we want to look at, are they overly preoccupied about being online and having their devices? When they're doing in-person activities, are they thinking like, I want to check my phone, I want to be on my phone? But also, is it impacting their sleep, their eating, their behaviors? Are they not completing their homework? Are they spending too much time isolated? And then through conversations, you can get an idea of what they're thinking. Are they overly comparing themselves to others? Are they feeling excluded and isolated? So definitely important to talk with children and understand what's going through their heads.
So I have a 9-year-old, 9.5-year-old. She's a fourth grader. And one of the conversations I've started to have with her friends' moms is, when do they get the smartphone? When do we allow them access to certain kinds of apps? Now, I think she's too young for Instagram, TikTok, especially Twitter. Mm-hmm. I don't know what a 9-year-old would have to do on Twitter. But, like, it is coming. And that is that conversation that's happening.
Absolutely. And right now we don't have science that tells us straight up, at this age, it is safe. Technology companies say 13 and up. The Surgeon General has said he thinks that's too young. So what we recommend at Kids Mental Health Foundation is knowing your child, because the risk varies by kid. If your child is open with you, trusts you, comes to you with problems, if your child follows rules and boundaries, if your child is confident in themselves and doesn't worry too much about peer pressure and what others think, all those are signs that they may be ready. Again, with communication, teaching them healthy ways of using social media, those boundaries. But we want to look at those things that may put them at risk, like existing mental health concerns, or maybe a parent-child relationship that has a lot of conflict. And so then we worry that they may not follow the rules of safe use.
Yeah. You also emphasize the importance of check-ins and sort of reevaluating your plan. Obviously, social media access changes as you age, but it can also change if it's just not working.
Right. And apps change all the time, right? The algorithm changes all the time. So I may be on an app and really enjoying it and it's helping me connect, and then something changes and now I'm exposed to content that is making me sad. Or maybe bullying starts to happen. Or as you mentioned, kids are often exposed to racism on these apps. And so we have to just keep checking in. And sometimes in therapy, I'll ask my patients, how do you feel after social media? And they just kind of pause and reflect and, oh, maybe not so great, right? So we talk about, who are you following? What are you consuming? What are you doing on it?
We're also having this conversation as a state right now about how much access children should have to their phones, in particular when they're at school.
Mm-hmm.
And this is all over the map right now. The state legislature has essentially said you need to come up with a plan to restrict the use, but they're leaving it largely up to the discretion of the individual districts.
Yes, and that's hard because we know that, I can talk on the science, right, which tells us that phones are distracting. The algorithms are created to suck us back in and to want us keep engage and check.
Oh, I can lose an hour in TikTok.
Exactly.
It happens. Like, I am an adult woman with a college degree and it absolutely
gets me. A developed brain, right? And it gets us. And so we know that if I'm trying to do homework and my phone is next to me, I'm going to have less focus. And so, you know, I think school districts have to take the science into account when deciding what is best for their students. But, you know, if I'm working with a family on creating a space at home for homework, I will always say keep it technology free so that the kids can focus and then they can have access to the technology.
That is challenging, though, when you need your laptop to do your work.
Exactly. Kids get the Chromebooks and the laptops and access to all these things. And so it's not as easy as just no technology, right? Technology is here. We're using it. It's helpful. So it is a tough decision.
Yeah, I think I don't even know if you could hand in handwritten essays anymore.
Right. I mean, some kids, like we always talk about, they're not learning cursive and all these things. So
yeah, I think in a lot of high schools, even it's submitted online even still. Mm-hmm. So there's no actual physical printed copy brought in anymore.
Right. And all the discussion boards that we're using now and to react to the content we're learning. So it's definitely here and prevalent.
I also think, I don't know, I feel is very conflicted about it as my own kids get mm-hmm. older, about, because I use it for work, which is a whole other complicated thing, because there's a certain amount of access that I have that I am supposed to have as part of my job.
Right. Yeah. My 4-year-old knows that I use technology and social media for work. Sometimes I'm like, hey, let's make a video for work. And so they're seeing us again. We are modeling the behavior. And so it is about, as the older they get, the bigger conversations you can have and just talking about it, like sharing. I use social media in this way, but here are my boundaries. Here's when I turn it off. Here's the people I don't follow because I feel sad or upset, and just being open like any other thing in the world.
Also about what kind of content you do or don't share, or how the yes. sharing of that content can live with you forever.
Exactly. Talking about safety and how whatever you post is there, how it can be used against you. And so it's constant conversations. And one thing I talk with parents all the time is that it's not just about social media. We know that a healthy parent-child relationship is the most protective factor that a child needs for their mental health. And so it's just building that trust, that teamwork, that I come to you when I need you. And again, I trust you. And so when that healthy relationship is in place, then we know that the risk of social media is a little lower.
Well, that's good to know. That's reassuring.
Absolutely.
Yeah, particularly when it comes to how to navigate the foreverness of the internet. Because, like, I mean, I'm an elder millennial, and I always joke that I'm, like, so thankful that I went through middle school and high school and a large part of college without Facebook. Mm-hmm. Like, that, you know, those angsty things that I wanted to write as, like, an eighth grader who broke up with her first boyfriend, like, lived in a little journal and didn't live on the internet.
Right. Instead of people being able to pull them out 20 years later. And
that would be horrifying.
Right,
like,
exactly.
I'm so happy none of that content exists digitally.
Exactly. And it's really hard because, again, kids, their brains are developing. And so it is normal for kids to say and do things that when they get older, they're going to cringe and be like, oh, my gosh, you know, I can't believe that lives out there. And a lot of it, we laugh and just kind of roll our eyes out. But some of it can be harmful. And so we do really have to talk to our kids, again, almost daily, because their brains just don't get it yet. They're not there. They're not adult brains. They can't process in the way that we process.
Do you have any tips on how we as adults can hold ourselves more accountable to healthy social media habits? I'm sure a lot of people listening are not really happy when like the screen time notification shows up on their own phone.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is my job and I have a hard time with it, right? There's different things that we can do. You mentioned charging stations at home. So keeping your screens out of the bedroom is really important for our sleep habits. Setting those apps in our phones that will turn off certain apps that we overuse. But I am guilty of it turning off and then me overwriting that.
Yeah, it gives you the option. It's pretty easy. You just like click, ignore.
Yep. So it takes a lot of will. And again, that's where I say like kids don't have that yet. If adults don't have it, kids are definitely not there yet. And so it is tough. It takes that those behavioral changes. Building habits take time. So keep practicing, stick to it. And hopefully another big thing that's helpful is replacing it with something else. So instead of saying, I'm not going to use my phone in the bedroom, say what you are going to do. Well, I'm going to read a book before I go to bed. And so you're finding a replacement for that habit.
Yeah, and I think people, like kids are more observant than we think they are a lot of the time, especially if you are scrolling social media absentmindedly after a stressful day. I think they internalize, oh, that's how I relax when I've had a stressful day. Like,
right.
I drink a glass of wine and I like look at TikTok for an hour.
Exactly.
Because like that's what mom does.
Exactly. They're really learning. And so being able to model it and label, I had a hard day, so I'm going to sit here and do some breathing. I'm going to do a yoga video, whatever it is that you cope. And exactly what you said, if they see us instead scrolling on our phones, sitting on the couch, then they're going to learn that that's a way. And that's okay sometimes, right? But we don't want to do that every day.
So where do we find you and the Kids Mental Health Foundation online if people want more information?
Sure. So you can go to kidsmentalhealthfoundation.org. All of our resources are free for teachers, parents, coaches, any adult with a child in their life can come to our website. We also have an e-community where you can receive a free email every week that has our latest resource.
Oh, what are these like new resources that come out every week?
Sure. So to give you an example, it's back to school season. So this month we have been sending resources about school connection and the importance of kids connecting. We've sent resources on sleep and getting back into routines. We have sent information about friendships. And so every week it's a different resource about mental wellness. So we're really talking upstream. How do I build healthy habits in my child for their mental health and wellness? And then sometimes we'll also share for those parents that may be concerned. You know, what is anxiety? What is depression? What do I do if I'm worried?
I love that that's so much a part of the conversation around the social media. It's not don't use it, just ban it. It's how do we build such a strong foundation that they're not impacted by it?
Exactly. We know that there's also benefits. There are children that really need to find that community online because they may not be getting it in the home or in the school. And so we can't just say no social media, right? But we can say here's what we know so far based on the science that is helpful for children. And here's how we build those boundaries in the home and in the schools.
That was Ariana Howitt, Clinical Director of the Kids Mental Health Foundation. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we're talking Labor Day sales and what you should take advantage of and when. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from The Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. California lawmakers are going to vote on a bill to regulate the development and implementation of artificial intelligence in the state. But this comes as tech companies like OpenAI are pushing back. Here to talk about it with me, as always, is Russell Hawley, Managing Editor of Commerce at CNET. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So tell us about this law being pushed through the California Senate. What kind of restrictions would it put on artificial intelligence development?
Yeah, so the bill's name is SB 1047, and it is currently aimed at basically allowing there to be backdoors and kill switches in place for artificial intelligence that's being used in systems that are critical to the infrastructure of the state. So essentially, if there is an artificial intelligence platform that is used on the power grid, there's a way to turn it off in the case that that is doing something that we maybe don't want it to do, or is maybe following instructions in a way that is very different. It's really worth highlighting that the systems that we're talking about here are materially different from OpenAI's ChatGPT, which currently is incapable of telling you how many R's are in the word strawberry.
Yeah, so this is like if the power grid has an AI component and we think that it's acting funny, we could turn it off. Like if AI is making some adjustments, say during peak usage hours, to how power is going out to avoid an outage.
That's right. The bill also requires there to be third-party auditors to come in and make sure that safe practices are being followed and that whistleblowers are being cared for, as well as some, you know, kind of basic compliance issues regarding, you know, anything that what they limit as costing more than $100 million to develop, you know, has some kind of regulatory control over it, you know, to, you know, make sure that these things are controlled in some way, or at a minimum able to just be turned off. And in the case that they're not following those guidance, that there are significant fines involved.
So OpenAI, their chief strategy officer, Sam, has come out and just said that this law would threaten growth, slow the pace of innovation, lead California's engineers and entrepreneurs to leave the state. Essentially, they don't like this legislation.
Yeah, it's worth pointing out that this is the same company that has said on multiple quoted times that they wish that the government would put some legislation in place, as odd as it is for a company to say, please, someone stop us from doing this thing that morals don't stop us from doing. Be able to come in and you know, kind of have that regulation in place. The big issue here is, you know, the code threshold would make it so that other companies would leave the state of California in order to pursue smaller projects that could then be sold to larger places. That's kind of the way that argument is being raised at the moment.
So what chances? I know you're not a political reporter, but like, does this have a chance of becoming law?
I mean, it passed the House overwhelmingly. Currently, the thing that is standing in its way is quite a bit of pushback from Nancy Pelosi and Ro Khanna, who say that this is, you know, kind of a step too far in the way that it regulates. There's not a lot of specifics for what it is that Pelosi and Khanna don't like, just that this is something that needs refinement before it's something that gets passed. So it's possible that it doesn't pass the Senate, but the way that it overwhelmingly passed the House, it is likely to reach Gavin Newsom's desk before the end of the month.
Do you think it could serve as a framework for AI regulations across the country? I mean, we talk about model legislation sometimes as politics reporters, and a lot of times, though, especially in terms of regulatory framework, California can set the standard, particularly when it comes to things like vehicle emissions.
That's right. I think that there's kind of an interesting pair of parallel conversations that are happening right now when it comes to artificial intelligence in, you know, kind of government settings versus the kind of consumer settings. Usually when you and I talk about artificial intelligence regulation, it's really more about, you know, kind of misinformation and disinformation being shared in places that are just, you know, kind of unsafe or dangerous. This is a lot more, you know, kind of using artificial intelligence in things like hospitals and, you know, kind of our power infrastructure and things like that. And so, you know, I don't think that there is a one size fits all kind of legislation that will reach both of those conversations at the same time. I think it needs to be handled differently for each case. And it doesn't seem like that conversation is happening in that way, which I think is where some of that pushback is coming from.
Yeah, I also wonder how granular it would get, because, you know, you see Gemini and some of the others being offered as, you know, email generation, help you send off an email without actually having to type it out. And for government purposes, I mean, that is the creation of a public document. You sort of wonder about like the technology that's going in and writing emails for official purposes. But I don't know, I guess we'll have to see how integrated it gets.
That's right. And I think also missing from a lot of this conversation is the disclosure of what is and is not being, you know, used or modified by artificial intelligence, especially in a government setting. I think that's incredibly important. You know, if artificial intelligence is being used for my governor writing an email to me, I would want to be aware of that.
Yeah. I mean, nowadays it's probably like an assistant or an intern or somebody opening the mail and replying. They have like whole communication teams that handle the mail. So odds are it's probably not your governor writing back to you if you get a reply, but you never know.
That's exactly right.
But yeah, I think there is a difference between a human in their office and an AI bot just writing you back.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I guess I suppose that's the point where we could talk about those candidates that continue to pop up as artificial intelligence candidates.
Absolutely delighted to report that the UK candidate that was running as artificial intelligence did not even reach 3% of the vote in that area.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm ready for AI politician just yet.
Not at all.
Let's switch it up and talk a little bit about Apple. They're going to be unveiling the new iPhone 16 and the next generation of Apple Watches at their event on September 9th. I know they've been playing it pretty close, but any more details that you have now about what may be coming? Are we getting like a fourth lens on the back of the iPhone?
Probably not a fourth lens, but you know, two big things that Apple has been very clearly focused on with the software releases that it has made for the next version of the operating system is how Siri can be more deeply integrated into everything. So there, you know, we have this. If you use an iPhone, you know that there's a big friendly button up above the volume rocker that you know has. You know, previously been like a, you know, turn off the microphone or, you know, make sure that it can't, you know, kind of ring at you when you want it to. It's likely that that button, which Apple calls the action button, is going to be quite a bit more useful when it comes to, you know, triggering Siri and being able to, you know, generate some other functionality there. I don't know that the physical hardware is going to change terribly. Apple's probably going to talk about a new, slightly faster processor and maybe a battery improvement when it comes to how long the phone is going to last in specific situations. But this really appears to be a release that is very software oriented. So if you're very happy with your iPhone right now, this may not be the year to upgrade, but we'll see, you know, what it is that gets rolled out there. For the Apple Watch, there's been so many different focuses on, you know, kind of more sensors that can get put into these watches so that more, you know, kind of biological data can be grabbed to provide a better look. And after last year, when the UK injunction came in and stopped the sleep tracking system from working the way that Apple intended to, it's likely that a new version of that technology will be announced along with this watch.
I do find it interesting that it is, I mean, Siri's been around for what, 12 years now? It's been around for a long time. And it's always kind of been silly. I mean, it gives you directions, it can kind of answer questions, but the idea of it turning into a full AI assistant, it feels like it's the culmination of what Apple's been building towards for the last decade.
That's right. And if you look at it in comparison to the biggest competitor, you know, Amazon has reported massive losses in its intelligence division year over year over year as it, you know, was able to kind of one up the way that Siri performed. And there's just no indication that it seems terribly worth it. You know, there aren't people who are absolutely beholden to having the Amazon devices in their house that they're not things that they can't live without. Whereas the folks who use Siri, who have been using it from the beginning, really see it as a value add that is kind of a part of their day-to-day life. So it is entirely likely that, you know, when we have this conversation in 3 years, that you know, Apple fans who are really into Siri end up being the ones on top.
And I should say, you know, since we touched on the idea of misinformation a second ago, that, you know, if you see some crazy photo of a new iPhone or some new piece of technology, run it through like Google image search or something, because there's also some misinformation that comes around right before these Apple announcements.
That's exactly right. There is always an effort to, you know, kind of be the first person to share a new thing about an iPhone. Most folks aren't going to know what's going on until the 9th when Apple tells us.
Can I ask, who determines who gets invited to those events? Like, how do you get invited to the big show?
Apple's PR team does an enormous amount of research every year to see who it is that they can invite to those events, including, you know, folks who are just prominent on YouTube or folks who are, you know, kind of, you know, very social media heavy. It tends to be a mix of folks who are very excited about the upcoming technologies.
Are you guys sending anybody this year?
We will definitely have a few people live at the event, yes.
So we'll have to circle back and see what actually appears. Also, Labor Day is coming, and there's usually a number of Labor Day sales on technology. But, you know, I think it's hard as we look. Gosh, I hate that I'm saying this, but I mean, like, look, the stores are already putting Christmas stuff out. So I suppose I can say it, right? Like, it's hard to say, like, should I buy it now or should I wait until later on in the year when we start to get Black Friday sales, when we start to get Christmas sales? Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's kind of the big conversation there is that, you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff that, you know, is going to be presented as the biggest sale ever over the next couple of months. And, you know, I have to choose kind of when it is that you're going to buy stuff. You know, what we know from kind of historical data is that you're going to see if you are a fan of upgrading to maybe a new iPhone or something like that, prices for those are going to go way down during the Labor Day event. And that's because immediately after Labor Day, Apple's going to be announcing new phones. So you're not, if you're not excited about, you know, kind of the latest and greatest, and you just want, you know, kind of a really reasonable price on a new phone, that's usually a pretty good time to grab a new iPhone. That's where usually some of those best deals for the current version are going to be available. This is also kind of the last time of the year that you see really steep discounts on some of those bigger purchases like mattresses and appliances and stuff like that. Again, because the next year's versions are going to start coming out and be a big part of holiday sales and things like that. So if you're not crazy excited about making sure that you have the very latest and shiniest grill, you'll probably find a pretty good deal on a really good one this year, this season. Anything that you're going to see on Amazon or Walmart or something like that, my biggest bit of advice to anybody who wants to know that they're actually getting a deal on something that's not just kind of an artificially discounted price, there are some really great websites that you can use to confirm a price immediately. One is that we end up using a whole bunch at CNET is called Camel, Camel, Camel. It's three identical words all together. Very simple. What you do is you take a link from Amazon and you paste it into this thing and it will show you the price history. So if it has been recently increased and then artificially decreased down to the same price that it was 2 weeks ago, it'll show you in a really friendly graph. There is another very silly named, article generator that does the same thing for Walmart. It is called Aisle Gopher. I don't know who names these, but I want to be friends with all of them just to be super clear. But it's the same basic idea. You take the product from Walmart, you put it in this thing, and it will give you the price history to let you know if it is a real sale or if it's just something that has been messed with.
I do like the names Camel, 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 and Aisle Gopher. They're both fun.
Great.
Yeah. Another question, if you're buying online, is how to make sure that you're getting the genuine article. Because, like, I'm always afraid sometimes that, like, especially if it's, like, looks like a really good deal, how do I know that it's not, like, a DHgate set of AirPods?
Yeah, that's always a challenge, especially if you're not buying from kind of an original source. So my recommendation there would be to, you know, kind of stick to some of the larger retailers. If the price that you see on one website is just dramatically lower than the price you see on Walmart or Amazon or something like that, then there's probably a really good reason for it. And you should probably, you know, kind of stay away from that, you know, kind of third party that isn't a site you've shopped at before. Chances are you're probably not getting what it is that you have asked for.
Yeah, I think, I can't remember if it was you or somebody else we had who bought like a $10 pair of headphones on Temu and was like very disappointed in the sound quality. Although they looked a lot like AirPods, they did not function the same way.
Yeah, there is no such thing as a $10 set of headphones that you're going to be happy with.
I do find it fascinating that people still pretty reliably, like DHgate is one of those like infamous if you're buying like handbags or fake luxury goods, but they do a lot of luxury electronics. And I've always kind of wondered, like, I don't know, spending $150 on the lookalike, like over-the-ear AirPods, like, I don't know. It's just a fascinating like subculture.
Yes. And a lot of that comes from, you know, stuff where the outer packaging was damaged somehow, but the inside is still perfectly fine. So you can, you know, get the product at a discount. And the trade-off is that you don't have a warranty attached to it because you didn't, you know, like buy it from an official source. And there are some people who are perfectly fine with that. They can buy that thing and they're just going to use it until it dies and then move on anyway. But if you are not the kind of person who, you know, kind of regularly picks up the newest gadget, then you definitely want to be careful where specifically you're buying from.
Are there any categories of things that tend to go on sale better at Labor Day than, say, Black Friday?
So the big thing that we see for Labor Day is a lot of this is the last gasp sort of for outdoor stuff. So I mentioned grills earlier, but also outdoor lighting. This is a lot of stores are trying to free up space so that they can fill it with the holiday stuff that you have already started seeing in stores. So a lot of the kind of outdoor, you know, if you want, you know, kind of a new water sprinkle system or, you know, any kind of, you know, product like that, this is kind of the last time of the year that you're going to see really good discounts on that kind of thing. Also, if you're looking for indoor stuff, this is kind of a weird one. heated blankets tend to be super cheap around this time of year before the prices go up as the temperature comes down.
Oh, that's really weird. You would think it would be the opposite. Or I guess, I don't know, it's going to be like 97 degrees here this week. So maybe it is the moment to buy a heated blanket.
It's really hard to buy a heated blanket when it's 90 degrees outside, but this does tend to be one of the better times to do it.
That was Russell Holly, the managing editor for commerce at CNET. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thanks for having me.
And I want to say thank you to all members of the All Sides staff. That includes senior producer Marcus Charleston, producer Aaron Esmont Rabinowitz, our intern producers David Stein, Chris Corcoran, and Kira Kadar. Video production is by the Ohio Channel. Board operation comes from Chris Johnston and Cameron Howard. Alan DiCenzo is the composer of our theme music, WOSU Radio Chief Content Director Mike Thompson, 89.7 Program Director Amy Jurevich. Our Radio Operations Director, there's a lot of people who make All Sides possible, is Kevin Petrilla, and the Senior Broadcast Technician is Dalton Jones. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook, and you can follow us now on Instagram at All Sides WOSU. Thank you so much for listening here on 89.7 NPR News.